Keep silence before me, O coastlands, and let the people renew their strength. Let them come near, then let them speak. Let us come near together for judgment. Who raised up one from the east? Who in righteousness called him to his feet? Who gave the nations before him and made him ruler over kings? Who gave them as the dust to his sword and driven stubble to his bow? Who pursued them and passed safely by the way that he had not gone with his feet? Who has performed and done it, calling the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, am the first, and with the last I am he. The coastlands saw it and feared. The ends of the earth were afraid. They drew near and came. Everyone helped his neighbor and said to his brother, "Be of good courage." So the craftsman encouraged the goldsmith. He who smooths with the hammer, inspired him who strikes the anvil, saying, "It is ready for the soldering." Then he fastened it with pegs that it might not totter. Lord, help us to recognize our fears, to identify our idols, to fix our gaze upon you, our only hope. Amen. In a recent TV drama, one of the characters, commenting on world events, said, "When you hear about everything that's going on in the world today, doesn't it make you want to scream? And you sit and watch news reports these days on the television and listen on the radio from various places in the world, you can only sympathize with that idea. The UN reports that there are currently 110 wars taking place in the world, many of which I'm sure we have never even heard about. In the past few months, more than 300 Christians have been murdered by Islamic extremists in Nigeria. Churches burned. The army has been unable to protect Christian civilians and communities from years of systematic rape and cruelty. The rise of militant Islam in these past decades, with its aim to rule the world, has given rise to the most appalling crimes, hasn't it? Its brutality has been shocking for us. And over the past 2 years, we've seen the awful results of the Russian invasion of Ukraine that has turned that country into a meat grinder that has virtually chewed up and destroyed most of the male population of Ukraine. More recently, the Hamas terrorist attack upon Israel and the response to that has virtually reduced Gaza or much of it to dust. Well, what are we to make of all that? How are we to understand all that? Well, Isaiah here speaks of such a time of turmoil and of fear in the world. He speaks of he's speaking to a people who before long will find themselves in exile in Babylon, not long after he delivers this prophecy to them. And he's throwing light onto the situation that they are going to encounter then. It's a world in panic because of the rise of a coming conqueror. And he draws their attention then to a number of pictures, as it were. There's a lot of picture language, as you know, in the prophets. And the first thing we have here is a picture of a God who is in charge of history, who is directing and controlling the flow of history. So verses 1 to 3, God controlling history. Verses 1, the Lord calls the whole world, as it were, to appear before him in court. When it says, "Let us draw near together for judgment," that's referring to a court where there'll be a judicial judgment and the whole world being drawn together into this worldwide courtroom to get things settled, to have them straight. And then in the end of verse 2 and verse 3, he speaks of this conqueror who's going to arise, who is coming, and he's going to trample over the nations. Who raised up one from the east? Who in righteousness called him to his feet? Who gave the nations before him and made him rule over kings? Who gave them as dust to his sword, as driven stubble to his bow? Here is a coming world conqueror who is going to trample down the nations and kings. He's going to conquer and subdue the known world. Now that is a reference to Cyrus, He isn't named here, the king of Persia. He's mentioned in chapter 41, but then when you get to chapter 44, you find that the prophet actually mentions him by name. But at this point, he's not named, and along with other details, they'll be filled in later. Now, Cyrus didn't appear on the scene for another 150 years. And he was a great conqueror. He ruled northern Mesopotamia. He subdued Syria and what we call today the country of Turkey. He conquered Afghanistan and Lebanon and Israel. His son Cambyses went on to conquer Egypt and then Babylon. So Cyrus basically rolled over the whole of the ancient Near East, and he had that as an entire empire at his feet. As a king, he was quite a tolerant man. He allowed freedom of religion, religious expression in the empire. But his armies did kill, and his empire grew through bloody conflict and conquest. So as you look at verses 2 and 3, it looks as if you're just reading about the way things have always been in the world. That's how history constantly rolls on. It doesn't look as though anyone's in charge of history particularly. There are just those who go out conquering and rolling over anyone who stands in their way and crushing them to dust. It seems as though that's just the way it is. Nobody's in particular control or charge of it. It's just the way it is. Just think of some of the things that have happened in the past century. 1939, Adolf Hitler runs over Poland, his mechanized forces meeting the Polish elite cavalry armed with sabers on horseback, being annihilated by German armor. The Nazis were irritated by Yugoslavia's resistance. They wouldn't knuckle under, so the Luftwaffe pummeled and turned Belgrade into rubble. 17,000 casualties. That's the way history has gone, isn't it? China, between 1935 and 1940, there was a bandit army that roamed unrestrained through one of their provinces and in that time killed more than 4 million civilians, just murdered them. Butchery. Or think of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, where in just 1 year, 1975, they liquidated 1.2 million of their own people, just slaughtered them. Alexander Solzhenitsyn estimated on good grounds that between 1917 and 1949, more than 66 million souls were destroyed under the communist regime in that country. You think about those sort of things, and it looks as though over and over again, history sort of veers off course and careens into the darkness as conquerors arise and subjugate countless people. It just doesn't look as though anyone's in control of it. It seems as if history is going from one era of darkness to another. And yet we see something different here, don't we? That seems to be what's happening with this prediction of the rise of Cyrus, who by conflict and conquest will subjugate the ancient Near East. That's how it looks. That's how it appears to us. But that isn't actually how things are, says Isaiah. In verse 2, Isaiah tells us that it is the Lord who orders history. He says, who raised up one from the east? Who in righteousness called him to his feet? Who gave the nations before him? Who has stirred up this one from the east? The answer, the Lord has. Jehovah, the living God, has called this man to his feet. I am the one who brings Cyrus onto the scene. He says it is the Lord himself who calls Cyrus to his feet. Cyrus will be a king who, in fact, is a servant under God's direction. The Lord will give the nations before him, handing nations over to him, putting them under his control and his rule, and he, the Lord, will make Cyrus to rule and dominate kings. The Lord is in control of history. He raises up Cyrus. Well, then, does that mean the Lord is approving all the brutality involved in Cyrus's armies conquering the ancient Near East? No, it doesn't mean that. But it does tell us that the God of the tiny nation of Judah is running things. He is in control of kings. Psalm 75 says, pulling down one and lifting up another. He's the one who's in charge of the world, of politics. He's the one who is directing affairs that are not random, uncoordinated chance occurrences that tend to chaos. History is not a chain of senseless tragedies, but the Lord directs world events, he tells us. In this case, raising up Cyrus and giving the victory to him. Now that fact, I know, in itself raises all kinds of questions that I'm not even going to try to deal with now. But the point that Isaiah is making for us, you see, is that contrary to appearances, behind it all, behind every tyrant, behind every king and conqueror, every one of them is on the Lord's leash, not least Cyrus, when he arrives on the scene eventually. Now, many people, even Christian people, want to take issue with what Isaiah is telling us here. But if you don't want to take his word for it, if you want to reject what Isaiah is maintaining here, would you be willing to accept it from Jesus? Because you find the same teaching, don't you, on the lips of our Lord Jesus. Do you remember when he was on trial before Pilate on the night of his betrayal in John 19? And he wasn't being cooperative. He was refusing to speak. And Pilate says to Jesus, don't you know that I have power to crucify you? Power to release you? Don't you know that's my authority? Do you remember what Jesus says? You would have no authority over me at all unless it were given you from above. Pilate, the reason why you are sitting where you are is because my Father has put you there. Kings, presidents, prime ministers, tyrants, conquerors, they're only there because for whatever reason, God has given them that position. And that tells us then that history is not a rampaging chaos, but God is controlling it. God is directing it. That's the one picture that Isaiah gives us here. And then he holds up another picture for us to see. We have God in control of history, bringing forth King Cyrus to conquer the nations of the ancient Near East. And then in verses 5 through 7, we see the reaction of people to Cyrus's war machine. How do they react to the onslaught of the conqueror? Well, it's with alarm and fear and dread. Verse 5. And what do? Everyone joins together and begins to manufacture idols, make images of their gods. They begin to turn out more and more idols. That's how the world reacted to the rise of Cyrus. They turned to religion. You say, well, that's a good thing, isn't it, if people turn to religion? Of course, it all depends on what kind of religion it is. Verse 6 and 7 tells us they produced images of their deities. Today, they might talk about recovering spiritual values or whatever. But then, as now, that's a completely false refuge. So they go about the arduous task of making images, each artisan encouraging his colleague. Verse 7. So the craftsman encouraged the goldsmith. He who smooths with the hammer inspired him who strikes the anvil, saying, it is ready for the soldering. And he fastened it with pegs that it might not totter. That last phrase is Isaiah's mockery of idolatry. Here's the image of their deity, but it cannot move. It has to be nailed in place, or it'll just fall over. Now, those pagan people weren't stupid. It wasn't as though they thought the idol was the actual deity that it represented, but they thought that the image was a sort of conduit for their God's presence with them. But they did think that if they had the image, somehow they were controlling the image and their God. And by producing more and more images of their gods, they supposed that they were producing more and more conduits by which the power of their God would be present with them and operate amongst them. So in the face of the coming world crisis, of Cyrus sweeping away everything before him, that's how they reacted. They gave themselves to making more and more images of their gods. They turned to their idols with intensified devotion. And when Cyrus eventually did invade Babylon, for example, we know there this is just what Nabonidus did. He ordered every existing image of the gods to be brought into the city of Babylon to boost the spiritual strength of the city. That's how pagans think. That's the sort of thing they do. Very easy to see it there, though, isn't it? And it's right here in the text for us to read about. But it isn't so easy to recognize our own resorting to idols. It's much harder to acknowledge how much we rely on idols. How did the world respond to AIDS? Do you remember? For 20 years, 30 million Africans died from, 3 million Africans died from AIDS every year for 20 years. What do we do about that problem? Well, we have scientific research, and we put our hope and our confidence in the men with white coats to come up with a remedy. And we assume that money and time and technology and condoms, they'll get the job done. And science is our idol. Men and women in the white coats will get the job done. We've had the same reaction, haven't we, to COVID. And who knows how much that has cost the world. What about the incessant wars and disputes that are taking place around the globe? Are we placing our hope in the peace process? I'm not in favor of war, obviously, and aggression. But to hear many, you would think that in the face of aggression and injustice, the only thing you could possibly do is negotiate. Politicians, it seems to me, have this arrogant notion that they can establish peace by a piece of paper. And you can easily fall into that way of thinking. Diplomacy will be the answer. Diplomacy will save us. It'll solve anything, if only they're clever enough. Diplomacy can be an idol. Or confronted with the intractable social problems of the day, what's the inevitable recourse? Well, we're told over and over again that all we need is more education, better education, and the government has to get involved, and the government has to throw money at it. That's the answer. So we'll turn to the government. And we have to be alert to the fact that Christians dredge up idols too. We perhaps see far more easily the idols of a secular culture and a secular world, and then are blind to the idols that we make for ourselves. It's not just that things we look to are necessarily bad, but we can be subtly drawn to rely on them. And there's a certain problem that lies in that. In America today, there's a thing called the Barna Organization. They influence countless Christian leaders, not just in America, in Britain too. A man called George Barna started taking surveys, research surveys around America. One of the things he discovered is that 80% of Americans claim to be Christian. 80%. Then he discovered that half of the 80%, 40%, said they were born again. So the other 40% are not born again Christians, I take it. Only 8% said that their faith made any difference to the way they lived their life. You see, we have this tendency to idolatry. Have you ever thought, if only we could get more Christians elected to Parliament, what a difference that would make? If only we could achieve that, then the sky's the limit. What then? What then if that happened? I'm not saying it's wrong for Christians to go into politics, but it's a big mistake to think that's the answer and that'll bring security to us. We need to ask ourselves, what is my first resort? What am I depending upon? Where's the first place I turn? When fears and terrors take hold of my life, where do I turn? Do they drive me in the very first place to the living God? That's the question. And then Isaiah gives a third picture, and it's a picture of complete security. Complete security. Adequate security. Notice what he says in verse 4. Who has performed and done it, calling the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, am the first, and with the last, I am He. He makes this great declaration right in the middle of this passage. Notice what he says then. Who has performed it and done it? Well, performed what? He's referring to the raising up of Cyrus, this great conqueror. Who has brought him onto the scene? Who's given him the victory that he has? I have, says God. I have. And then he expands on that because he doesn't only call Cyrus, but he says he has called forth all the generations from the beginning. So it isn't that God is in charge only of prominent politicians and world events in that sense, conquerors, but he's in charge of all people. He calls all generations forth, he says. The whole of humanity God has brought into being. And then he declares how absolute and preeminent he is when he says, I, the Lord, am the first. Colossians chapter 1, 17, the Lord Jesus says he is before all things. Pagan deities, well, they often belong to divine family trees with various divine relatives. But the living God is the only God who has no genealogy. He derives life from no one. I am the first. And then he declares how enduring he is. In the last line of verse 4, and with the last, meaning the last things, I am he. I am the first. And when history reaches its end, the end of the line, I am he. I'm God there too. And so the living God comprehends the whole of history. He is the first, he is the last. He brings it all into being, and when it comes to an end, he will be still the enduring God, the God who is. And so all along the way, from the first to the last, there is no point at which God has ever let go of history. I wonder if you've ever caught a glimpse of this God, the God in whom alone we can have lasting security. He's come near to us. Mark, in his gospel, tells us about him. Chapter 6, verse 45 through 52, where we read that Jesus sent the crowds away after he had fed the crowds, and then he sent his disciples ahead of him in the boat across the sea, and he remained on the mountainside to pray. And a windstorm arose, and the disciples were in distress. They weren't in danger, but they were in distress, trying to make headway against the wind that was contrary to them. And in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus comes to them walking upon the sea. And when they see him, they're terrified. They're thinking it's a ghost, some kind of apparition. And then we read in verse 50, they all saw him and were troubled, but immediately he talked with them and said to them, be of good cheer, it is I. Be not afraid. Literally, I am he. The God of Isaiah 41, verse 4, appears to the disciples in Mark 6, verse 50. We identify people by how they talk. We're familiar with the concept of accents and terminology, differing according to different regions in the world. Many people carry their identities, and their talk identifies them to us. And here in Mark 6, verse 50, Jesus isn't just saying, it's okay Don't worry. It's me, Jesus. He's not just doing that. He's saying, I am he. He refers to himself there as the only God. And there in the turbulence of the storm, as Jesus came to them walking on the sea, he says to them, be of good cheer. I am he. Don't be afraid. Well, if Jesus is who he says he is, then he is the only Lord. And we don't need to be afraid. Whether I'm facing a world-subduing conqueror like Cyrus, or whether I'm scared witless in the middle of a storm, he is the only Lord, and he's the only security we need in a panic-ridden world. Now, I can tell you straight away, that isn't going to solve any of your problems. It isn't going to make you immune to disease or disaster. It isn't going to keep necessarily your life from falling to pieces around you. But in a society that's screaming its way to disaster, you can hear one voice saying to you, do not be afraid. Take